The wrath of divine love sounds so negative. Can't we just skip it? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, Emeritus Professor of Old Testament at Walla Walla University School of Theology. I am your host and study guide author. The theme for the overall quarter is God's love and justice. My conversation partners are Brant Berglund from the Walla Walla University School of Theology and Albert Handel, Walla Walla University campus chaplain. Welcome to both of you.
I'd say no. No, we can't skip it.
We can't skip it.
A part of me would like to, but we have to address it.
Yeah, okay. Now, I've included in the official study guide, I've taken a whole chapter from my book, Who's Afraid of the Old Testament God, the one dealing with Satan, because I think part of the problem with the Old Testament is there is almost no satanic figure. So if anything gets done of a negative note, guess who gets the credit? It's God. So there are only three places in the entire Old Testament where Satan is identified by name as a evil personality, supernatural personality opposed to God. And it was when my doctoral supervisor pointed that out to me that all of a sudden the lights came on. No wonder we don't like the Old Testament. Whatever happens, God does it, good, bad, or indifferent. Now, a brief explanation here for this chapter, and then we'll come back to our question about the divine wrath sounding so negative. The three places in the Old Testament where Satan is clearly identified as a supernatural being opposed to God is Job 1 and 2, 1 Chronicles 21, and Zechariah 3. And they were all either written or canonized late. So for much of the Old Testament, God is the one who is responsible for everything. Now, I'm going to skip over and come back to that question. Let's turn to the leading question, the wrath of divine love. And I'd like to tuck in here a quotation from Ellen White, Desire of Ages. Divine love has been stirred to its unfathomable depths for the sake of men and angels. Marvel to behold in the recipients of so great love, a mere surface gratitude. Angels marvel at man's shallow appreciation of the love of God. Heaven stands indignant at the neglect shown to the souls of men. Would we know how Christ regards it? How would a father and mother feel did they know that their child, lost in the cold and snow, had been passed by and left to perish by those who might have saved it? Would they not be terribly grieved, wildly indignant? Would they not denounce those murderers with wrath as hot as their tears, intense as their love? The sufferings of every man are the sufferings of God's child, and those who reach out no helping hand to their perishing fellows beings provoke his righteous anger. This is the wrath of the Lamb. To those who claim fellowship with Christ, yet have been indifferent to the needs of their fellow men, he will declare in the great judgment day, I knew you not, whence you are, depart from me, for you are all workers of iniquity. There's something wrong with us if we can't get angry. Now, the problem is, in the New Testament, patience is on every virtue list. Anger is on none of them. Most of us don't need help getting angry.
We need help knowing when to be angry.
Yes, that's true. Now, I was surprised in our lesson here that all of a sudden, out of the blue, we have peace on Jonah. Now, the question is that Jonah was angry that God was being too compassionate. But as I got to thinking about Jonah, there are several reasons why it's very important, and I'd like to toss those three out here to see if you can give me a question. If you were to prepare a study guide just on the book of Jonah, how might you prioritize the following points? Now, for Adventists, it's been conditional prophecy. God says 40 days and then it will be destroyed. And when the people repented, God repented. So it's conditional prophecy. And then you have an unconverted prophet as a powerful preacher. That was Jonah. He was not converted. He was really angry when he discovered what God was willing to do. And then thirdly, you have a God more gracious than the people.
Or his prophet.
Or his prophet. Yes. I read what I put down here for Jonah. Jonah was angry when the people repented and God changed his mind about punishing them. But to Jonah, this seemed very wrong. And he became angry. He prayed to the Lord, isn't this what I said, Lord, when I was still at home? This is what I tried to forestall by fleeing to Tarshish. I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. And then in Jonah 4, 9 to 11, God said to Jonah, "Is it right for you to be angry about the plant?" He says, "I am so angry, I wish I were dead." But the Lord said, "You have been concerned about this plant, though you did not tend it or make it grow. It sprang up overnight and died overnight. And should I not have concern for the great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left hand, and many animals?"
I love how the cows make an appearance a couple times in that story too. I'm a father, and I have two children who, when they were younger, we had a couple experiences where there was a group of kids in the area who mistreated my kids a bit, and my kids were like me, a little rambunctious at times, but they weren't doing anything wrong, and they weren't taking anything wrong, but they were mistreated, and I was amazed how quickly I wanted to jump in and defend my children from all that was being done to them. And I wondered about that. And at the time, my wife and I talked about it. It's like, to what degree do we step in as parents to right the injustices? To what, you know, they weren't in any great physical harm at the moment, but that it wasn't good. But my defensive nature over my children was quick, and it burned hot. And I didn't step in, somewhat to my wife's credit. But I'm curious, you know, about is that the wrath of God? Is that the wrath that he feels when he sees his children suffering needlessly or being mistreated? And I believe he has wrath against sin and what it causes.
You know, the strange thing, Brent, is that when you have child abuse, you know, we tend to throw the book at the parents who abuse their children. But in almost every case, the one who abuses the children was abused as a child. So how do you step in there and break that and be fair? That's a question which I've never been able to get a good answer on. Our study guide talks about what he calls a cycle of rebellion. And this gives the cycle, he gives the cycle as follows. The people rebel against God and do evil, sometimes in even horrendous atrocities, such as child sacrifice and other abominations in his sight. God withdraws according to the people's decisions. The people are oppressed by foreign nations. The people cry to God for deliverance. God graciously delivers his people. The people rebel against God again, often more egregiously than before. But God repeatedly forgives, meeting humans with unending faithfulness. Psalm 78:38, this week's memory text, declares the state of God's continuing restoration. But he, being full of compassion, forgave their iniquity and did not destroy them. Yes, many a time he turned his anger away and did not stir up all his wrath. Then I noted here that Nehemiah 9 documents this cycle in Israel's history. Amos also offers more examples of this cycle. Amos 7:1-2 describes how the Lord was preparing another dose of destruction when the prophet cried out, "O Lord God, forgive, I beg you. How can Jacob stand? He is so small." And the Lord relented concerning this. "It shall not be," said the Lord. Now, the one other thing that I think we have a little bit of time left, but I hope we can process this, is righteous indignation. Is that a good idea?
I think righteous indignation is something that we, it's in the eye of the beholder, right? When I'm upset about something, it's righteous, and I'm justified in my indignation. Yeah. And when you're upset about something, you have anger problems. And so I think it's important to have some kind of standard for how we view these different things, because I feel that there's a lot to be righteously indignant over.
Yeah.
And other people would say, no, you just have an anger problem.
I've heard people use that phrase as an excuse for their misplaced or over anger towards a situation. They actually use it as an excuse, and that has been concerning to me. Oh, that's just my righteous indignation. I wouldn't have been so angry, but, you know, God led me to my anger. And it's like, I've heard people excuse their behavior.
But I guess, you know, in my work with young people, I think I could say that that is a generational concern. I would say much more the problem today, as I see it amongst the students that I work with on a daily basis, is an apathy that would be served with a greater degree of righteous indignation over anything. Are you upset about anything from a moral origin?
Does anything move you?
Does yeah. God's God's character cause you to be concerned about anything? And so righteous indignation is almost yes, it can be abused, I guess we could say. It can be misunderstood. But I see it as possibly a spark that your heart is beating according to the rhythms of God, and you're being moved in the way that God is being moved. And it's, yes, maybe it can be abused, but its absence is just as concerning.
Now, there are some interesting passages here that I'll cite these quickly, and then our time will be up. Jesus' cleansing of the temple is perhaps the best known example of Jesus' righteous indignation. But it's very interesting, as one New Testament scholar said, when Jesus cleansed the temple, he attacked the furniture, not the people. And so it's dangerous when you strike out to people. Mark 1, 3, 4, and 5. Jesus' anger when challenged about healing a paralytic on the Sabbath. He looked around at them in anger. And that's quite interesting that Jesus had the anger about healing a paralytic on the Sabbath. And then Mark 10, 13 to 14. Jesus' indignation when the disciples tried to send the children away from him. When Jesus saw this, he was indignant. He said to them, "Let the little children come to me, and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these." So, do you think we practice too much righteous indignation or not enough?
I'd love to be moved by these same things.
I would say not enough, my brother. Not yep. enough.
Not yep. enough. All right. We'll go and practice righteous indignation then. And we will bring this discussion to a close. Thank you to Brent and to Albert, my conversation partners, and to Kristen Byerly, our program engineer. To all of you for listening in for The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.